Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. See, I always thought Victorian values came from the Queen herself. My grade school social studies text had a full-length portrait of Queen Victoria. She was fully clothed, in black, up to her neck, black to her wrists, and wearing a frown of imperial disdain capable of withering even the liveliest sense of excitement. Okay, I was wrong. It turns out Queen Victoria actually gave paintings of nudes to her husband Prince Albert on his birthdays. Mark that one down on your list of clever cocktail remarks. But the well-buttoned sense of Victorian values is well-established. So when the Tate Britain put together an exhibit and called it Exposed, the Victorian Nude, well, it raised a few eyebrows. Didn't think anyone was ever nude in the late 1800s, certainly not in England anyway. But the exhibit exposes more than the images of figure painting and sculpture of that time. It strips away the myth that the very word Victorian represents. Connection listeners, what sort of image does Victorian present to you? Is there room in that picture for a full-length auburn-haired maiden with a snake slithering up her smooth, absolutely naked body? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Oh, and you can also see a gallery of images from the exhibit. It's on our website. We are at theconnection.org. Mark that down as well. Exposed, the Victorian Nude, the exhibit, is now making its only stop in the United States. The Brooklyn Museum of Art, the curator from the Tate who conceived the show is Allison Smith. She joins us from the NPR studios in New York, and with her is Virginia Dodier. Virginia is an art historian and a specialist in photography from the 1800s. She wrote the captions for the photos in the catalog of the exhibit. Now, we'll talk to Virginia in a moment, but first to Allison Smith. Hi, Allison. Thanks for coming in.
Hello.
Now, I'm going to ask you to take us through some of the assumptions about the Victorian era, because no doubt you've had them all piled on you ever since you first conceived the idea of the show.
Certainly. For many people, the idea of the Victorian nude is a contradiction in terms. The idea that the nudity didn't really exist in art in the 19th century. This is something which intrigued me when I first came to investigate the subject.
So your idea was the same as mine, that Victorian era was strict and old-fashioned and outdated and prudish?
This is what I'd come to believe, particularly by reading books such as Kenneth Clark's famous text, The Nude. He refers to the great frost of Victorian prudery. And since that, as a student of art, I've been led to believe that the nude really was specialist of artists in France and Germany around that time, not really in Britain. But when I came to investigate the subject and looked at it very closely, I discovered that the Victorians were actually obsessed with the subject, not just in the realm of fine art, but also in general culture as well. And going to museums and galleries around the country, I asked if they had any sort of nudes in stock, as it were, and being taken to the basements of galleries and museums, they unearthed amazing images, paintings and sculptures. And it was really from looking at these particular images I began to sort of piece together the broader picture of the subject.
So where did we get it wrong, Allison? Where did we come up with the notion that the Victorian era was one of tremendous buttoning down?
I think the Victorians themselves are partly to blame. This idea of prudery developed in the 19th century, particularly by advocates of the nude themselves, of advocates of modernism. They tended to dismiss what they considered to be more conservative elements in society as being rather prudish, and they often related this to a Protestant mindset or mentality. And of course it developed in the early 20th century in the Edwardian era, particularly among the so-called advocates of European modernism, who have dismissed the Victorian academic tradition as being rather backward, academic, academic, rather sort of unfussedy, and they sort of, you know, looked towards the continent and saw the sort of the impressionist and post-impressionist styles as being more avant-garde, progressive and forward-looking.
You made a mention...
the body in a more honest way.
Sorry, Alison, you made a mention of the church, and that's actually a key part of the story, because at the same time as the Protestant church in England was not supporting high art, it was getting a tremendous amount of support on the continent from the Catholic church, right?
That's true, and I think this idea about, you know, Catholic versus sort of Protestant attitudes towards the body, this was a very important part about the whole sort of debate surrounding the nude in the 19th century. The Victorians, i.e. the British, tended to associate the nude with sort of new corrupt Catholic tastes, you know, arguing that, you know, our sort of Protestant sense of morality does not allow the depiction of the naked form. They also related it to a heathen or pagan mentality. But on the other hand, there were sort of new Protestants who thought there should be the appearance, they advocated the appearance of the nude in art. They thought human beings were made in the image of God. We all came into the world naked, and they felt it, there was something so beautiful in this, and the naked body should be appreciated as something pure and decent.
So the
attitudes are rather contradictory there.
I have to tell you that as I read through your notes in the catalogue, I actually laughed out loud when you got to the part about the way that the English art world wanted to see itself in contrast to the French art world, that in some way defining Englishness was defining something that was not French. I want to read the quote that you use from the 1862 edition of the Art Journal. You quote them as saying, "A deeply rooted sense of propriety has not a little to do with the paucity of naked women on the walls of English exhibitions. The French do not even pretend to delicacy. Our notions, fortunately for the morals of our people and certainly for the good manners of society, happen to be different. And so English pictures are, for the most part, draped."
That's a fascinating quote. In fact, the British attitude towards the French is highly contradictory. On the one hand, bearing in mind this is a climate of intense imperial rivalry, the British tend to associate the French with sort of new corrupt, they call it Asiatics of morals, really, the idea that the French and Asiatic nations were sort of new corrupt and degenerate. On the other hand, there was an awareness that the French were far superior when it came to sort of new drawing and painting and sculpting the nude. And so a lot of British artists, rather than pitching themselves against the French, particularly in the later middle part of the 19th century, actually took themselves off to Paris to study in the studios and ateliers there and absorbed French working methods and brought these techniques back into Britain. And some people felt, you know, in the later part of the 19th century, that this idea of the English nude, or what should really comprise the English nude, was being corrupted by these imported French methods.
So did the English painters of the time do anything to make their nude paintings in any way distinct, or did they all look like classical work or imitations of what was happening in France or elsewhere on the continent?
I think it's very difficult to actually define the sort of quintessentials of new English nude or Victorian nude. And I think anyone going around the exhibition at Brooklyn will be aware immediately just how diverse and varied the representations are. I think this is sort of fascinating. I think it also relates to the point you raised earlier about attitudes towards the Victorian, because rather than just being sort of new, considered under this a blanket heading of being sort of hypocritical or prudish, we can actually see it was a very experimental, adventurous age in which artists were experimenting with all sorts of techniques, approaches and methods. So on the one hand, they were absorbing the latest ideas from the continent. On the other hand, certain artists were sort of new producing images of the body which pitched themselves against continental traditions. They were trying to define what the national body should be. So I think it's very sort of difficult to give a very clear answer to that. But I think the diversity is perhaps the issue we should really concentrate on here, because I think in the Victorian era, perhaps we should see it more in terms of sort of new adventure, sort of spontaneity, curiosity, really. And I think this really relates to the fact this was a sort of new, the birth of the modern age, really. New artists were sort of new exploring the body, not just in a nostalgic way, but also trying to relate it to sort of developments in modern society.
There was, though, something of a tentativeness. I mean, the paintings of women, most of them from the Victorian age, are had the curves very well softened, the pubic hair is removed, the breasts are exposed, but the nipples are sort of gauzy, as if the painter couldn't quite decide whether or not he or she wanted to have people look at that. And as you look through the photographs and the way that the English painters painted the nudes in that century, do you see a change? Do you see an emboldening of the art world?
Well, certainly, though I think you could see this, you know, it goes backwards and forwards. Take an early artist such as William Etty, the nudes he exhibited in public certainly conform with the academic tradition of the nude, in which all signs of particularity or nakedness have to be transcended. Remember, the academic tradition did insist on this distinction between nudity and nakedness. Nudity is really sort of nakedness or the real body transcended. But if you actually look at his private studies, those he executed in the studio as working aids, he often represented genitalia and bodily hair. And this emphasis comes back towards the end of the century, particularly with artists such as Sickert and Orpen and Steer, who really wanted to sort of celebrate sort of the ordinary naked body. And of course, in certain photographs which were used for then what was considered to be sort of new illicit purposes, treatment of the body is often explicit, far more so than would be considered acceptable in sort of high art forms, particularly in paintings and sculptures which were intended for exhibition in respectable contexts.
Why don't we bring Virginia Dodier into the conversation? Virginia's been sitting with Alison in the studio. Virginia, you're an art historian. You study the history of photography. When the Victorians first had what were in fact images of real bodies instead of imagined bodies, what did it mean?
Well, excuse me. I think it meant that precisely what it means to us today, which is that an image can exist in a public sphere, in a private sphere. An image can be passed from hand to hand. An image can be interpreted as a document or seen as an idealization. Something that's very interesting to me about the history of photography, of course, is that it's such a short history and that many of our attitudes are really consonant with those that the Victorians had.
And so do we see those, did the photograph arrive as art or did the photograph arrive as erotica?
The photograph of the nude?
Yeah, in the Victorian age.
Well, in the exhibition, I don't know whether you have these online, there is the famous O.G. Rylander, The Two Ways of Life. Do you have that online?
No, we don't. In fact, we have a handful of paintings online. So.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to refer to an 1857 photograph. It's actually a composite of many different negatives by O.G. Rylander, who was a Dane, or was he a Swede, who transplanted himself to England in the 1850s. And he had been trained, apparently, in Rome. And Alison was making reference to the continental traditions and how they were a bit different and the attitudes were a bit different on the continent than in England. And so Rylander imported a kind of artistic persona, a kind of bohemian persona, that meant that he could, to some degree, get away with the kind of works that he did. The Two Ways of Life is ostensibly a depiction of a biblical story, but it's not a real story. Anyway, it involves vice and virtue, and vice is represented by naked bodies.
Connection listeners, Victorian nudes, vice or virtue, and what don't we know about that time that we should learn? 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-TALK, and we are talking about the Victorian nude. Exposed, the Victorian nude, is an exhibit which opened recently at the Brooklyn Museum, and it was originally put together for the Tate Britain in London by Alison Smith, who joins us from the NPR studio in New York. She's there with Virginia Dodier, who's director of the Carlsbad Museum and Art Center at Carlsbad, New Mexico, and was brought in to add her scholarship to the photographs that are a part of that. And one of the features of going through and looking at the collection of both photographs and paintings that's there, perhaps, Alison, you can start with this, is that everything seems, or so much of it seems, to begin with bathing, that bathing was a theme that allowed people to address the issue of nudity that didn't automatically put them in the area of sex or erotica.
That's certainly true, and we have to bear in mind that this relates to the old master tradition. There are a lot of subjects from antiquity and the Bible which relate to the theme of bathing. Think of Susanna and the elders, for example, mm-hmm. or Diana and her nymphs bathing. So these were the sort of standard sort of, you know, pretexts for the nude, which didn't just exist in the 19th century, they existed before that. So that's an important starting point. Just coming on to the 19th century in Victorian Britain, this is often discussed as being the era of industrialisation, the growth of cities, a lot of soot, smoke and dirt. I think in relation to that, water stood for purity, cleanliness and hygiene. There are a lot of descriptions.
You know, this is the Charles Kingsley water babies, take Tom the chimney sweep and dunk
exactly.
him in the clear stream, right?
Exactly, yes. I think it's religious message, you know, overlaying that. The idea is to do with sort of, you know, on purity, rebirth. And this, of course, helps sanction the nude, the idea that your body being sort of, you know, cleansed and reborn. So often there's this Christian underpinning to the idea of bathing. Also, I think, you know, people lived in very cramped, crowded conditions. And bathing, nude bathing, was something which was, you know, considered completely acceptable in society in the countryside. Swimming was a sort of national sport and pastime, and particularly men, you know, they had the, you know, liberty to sort of, you know, throw off their clothes, leap into the sea and experience this sort of animalistic enjoyment in their bodies, which they couldn't when they were wearing normal costume, you know, being all strapped up in black and white. And indeed women at that time experienced a wonderful sense of liberation where they could throw off the corset, throw off the crinoline and leap into the water. So I think, you know, water is a, you know, wonderful sort of, you know, sort of starting point, really, for a discussion of the Victorian nude.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Alston, where Sandeep's been standing by. Hi, Sandeep.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks for calling.
Any discussion of the Victorian era would not be complete without a discussion of colonialism. And I think the story of this dichotomy that we are talking about is pretty much emblematic of the dichotomy that has pervaded Britain's colonial history. In other words, we are talking about the exterior Victorian prudishness, and then there is this other side where the nude clearly was acceptable in certain parts of Victorian society. This kind of correlates with the wider theme of Victorian society, which was that...
I need you, Sandeep, to be a little bit more specific, because my own experience of growing up in Canada is that the high Anglican Toronto Victorian view of the world would never allow a collar below the collarbone, but those crazy French in Montreal were up to anything that you could possibly imagine. So,
well, to give you an example, a person could actually get hanged in England for stealing bread, but England itself was wreaking tremendous havoc in the colonies in the 19th century, when the second sons could go out and rape and plunder the wealth of nations all over the world. So there is this dichotomy of Victorian society where there is strict morality on the outside, but only for some.
Well, I think that Alison will agree that even within the regard of the nude in Victorian England, there was this dichotomy that people, cartoonists certainly, flirted with the notion that nobody should look at what the butler saw, but everybody wanted to anyway, you know?
Right.
Of course, it's the idea of the double standard. This is an idea which was redeveloped in the mid-Victorian Britain. And I think we've become obsessed with it ever since. You know, the idea that Victorians were essentially hypocritical. You know, they would sort of, you know, faint in horror at the sight of a bare ankle. On the other hand, there was this thriving pornographic industry. But I hope the exhibition has done something to sort of question that, particularly in light of the way we approach the body today. I think, you know, it's just all too easy to dismiss the Victorians and say they were racist, they were misogynistic, they were exploitative of other sort of races and classes, where we're still, or I think, in fact, we're heir, really, to the sort of, you know, the problems they faced. But I think I want to come back to an earlier point Sandy raised about the colonial body, because I think this is very, very interesting for the Victorian nude. One of the reasons why the Victorians embraced the classical ideal was that they saw themselves as being heirs to the Greek tradition. They saw Greek sculptures as being sort of white and pure, sort of new, beautifully proportioned, and they saw themselves as being the supreme race in the world, as heir to that particular tradition. But at the same time, they were obsessed with notions of difference and otherness. And what you see happening increasingly in the later Victorian period is that the nude becomes far more eclectic, and as the empire expands, you have all sorts of different types of bodies that appear in representations of dark-skinned bodies, of Nubian bodies, often shown in sort of states of suffering, duress, subjugation. There's an amazing painting in the exhibition called Bondage, which is an Egyptian slave scene. And it shows from your pharaoh, Ramesses II, who was known for his promiscuity, according to the Victorians, choosing a selection of different slaves, and they're all different sort of new colours. And this is new, interesting. It tells us a lot about Victorian attitudes towards women of other cultures. And interestingly enough, in that particular composition, the darker the women they are, the more animalistic they're shown to be, the more accepting of their abject condition.
The sort of Orientalism of the National Geographic. That
exactly.
It's okay to show the naked breasts of the woman in the Amazon, but certainly not of the woman who's living in London.
Indeed. And the two white figures in that composition, the two white slaves, are shown to be ashamed and self-conscious of their nudity, in contrast to the darker-skinned women. So that tells you a lot about sort of new Victorian attitudes towards new other races. And indeed, this whole obsession you mentioned earlier on with the snake can be a sort of indication of the white body, particularly the white male wrestling with the snake. I'm thinking here of Frederick Leighton's athlete struggling with a python, which is one of the images you mentioned earlier on, which audiences, your listeners, can actually access.
Yes, that is one of the ones on our website. Indeed, it's a...
This hasn't been interpreted as an image of the white man really struggling with the colonial foe.
Could I just say, I think that all the contributors dealt as much as possible with the social context, with social history. And in fact, Allison and I did consider including photographic representations of colonial peoples. These were collected by anthropologists, scientists, who wanted to have a kind of compendium of the different racial and national types of the countries that they were dominating, that the British Empire was dominating. And in the end, Allison decided that we would not include those photographs, as they are more of a scientific rather than an artistic intent.
But it does come through in the painting. John Singer Sargent's contribution to the exhibit, the nude boy on a beach. Now, that would have been something he painted when he was away from England. Is that right?
Yes, that was painted in Capri, I believe. In fact, it was a study for a larger composition of nude boys on the beach in Naples. But, of course, Italy is something quite different from India or Africa. And we mentioned the British ambivalent attitude towards the French. In contrast to that, they were obsessed with the Mediterranean cultures, particularly the Italians, the work of the Italians and the Greeks. And the Italians were seen to have the most beautiful bodies at that particular time. This has a lot to do with the northern longing for the south, for the Mediterranean. And it's interesting that from the 1880s onwards, an increasing number of British artists, not just painters, but sculptors and photographers, took themselves off to Italy, to places like Sicily, Capri, and they painted the sort of young boys who was known to walk around scantily dressed, playing on the beach. These models, of course, were very sort of cheap to hire, and it has even been conjectured that the artists' relationships with the models was conducted on more than a purely professional level. In fact, this is where I could bring in Virginia here, about how photographers like Glurden actually sort of knew interacted with models. I think with someone like Sargent, that is a one is worth looking at as an image of a, you know, a young boy. It's a beautiful painting. It's very sort of loose and broad in its technique, and it has a wonderful. It shows the ease with which he captures that sense of. Sense of relaxation on the young boy on the beach. Mm-hmm. It was often said that the bodies of English people were the bodies of those who were unaccustomed to go around naked, whereas the bodies of Italians, these were people who could go around scantily clad and be completely at ease within their flesh. And this is something many 19th century people envied and longed for.
Virginia, why don't you take us into that controversy that exists over the photographs of children that were so much a part of what people had in the Victorian era?
Well, the photographs that the photographers that Alison was just referring to, the Baron von Glodden and his cousin Guglielmo Pluchot, or Pluchot, I'm not quite sure how to say it, they were Germans who located in southern Italy and took up photography as a profession, as a way of making money. And their primary subjects were boy nudes. They also did some girl nudes. Glodden is very much more well-known than his cousin Pluchot, but they worked with the same sets of models. We included some Pluchot and von Glodden photographs in the exhibition. I guess they're not on view online.
I'm told that rights issues are a bigger deal with some of the photographs, that in our attempt to try and get some of the ones that we've been talking about, that actually came up. But that's sort of by way of a weak apology to the people who will go to our website.
Well, shall I describe verbally one of the
Von
Glodden photographs? Well, it's two young men, perhaps in their teens, posing in a kind of Arcadian landscape. And a Pluchot photograph that I'm thinking of is of two boys, one older, one younger, one clearly post-pubescent, the other prepubescent, posing in a doorway, probably of Pluchot's villa, and kind of as bacchants, you know, with their arms over their heads in kind of a dance pose.
Yeah, the wreath and the grapes are about the only things missing from the photograph.
Yes, yes. Now, these photographs could be passed from hand to hand discreetly, from collector to collector, and if one collected these, you know, they could be explained away as, you know, I'm just admiring the beautiful bodies, or I'm preparing a sketch for a narrative painting and I needed two figures just in that pose, or I'm doing a genre painting of boys dancing in Naples. Or they could be quite straightforwardly part of a, shall we say, a soft pornography collection. Mm-hmm. And the two photographers that I was talking about were very much in business. On the backs of the photographs are the negative numbers and the photographer's address, name and address stamp, so that if one bought these, say, in Naples and went back home to London, you could order more. You just write and say, you know, I'll have some more of number 538, and if you've got any of that same model, I'll take those too. So
now help me with the context.
There was a trade.
Help me with the context here, though, Virginia, because it's too easy to forget how novel photography was to people at that time. Is that a part of perhaps the attraction?
Well, by this time that I'm referring to, say the late 1880s, 1890s, photography had been around in various forms for 50 years. So it was about as novel as, I would say, television is to us.
Oh, but I guess I meant whether or not the images were in the hands of common people by the late 19th century. Was that in any way part of the novelty?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes. I mean, photography was accessible to all strata
right,
of society.
Okay. So Lewis Carroll comes in here as someone who would take private pictures of naked little girls for their parents, was very diligent, or so I read, about destroying the negatives and making sure that he wasn't seen to be trading in pedophile
exactly.
photographs.
Mm-hmm, that's very important, yes.
But he does, I mean, he still gets marked for this, doesn't he?
Well, you know, it's funny. In the postmodern era, we seem to want it both ways. We seem to want to be able to see the images and revel in the sensuality and the beauty of them. And we want to also be able to say, my goodness, that's pretty, I don't know if I'd allow somebody to do that with my child. So I'm very much aware of that. And I've said to people about the Lewis Carroll photographs that, you know, I'm pretty much riding the fence. And what I wanted to do in my catalog entries, referring to the Lewis Carroll photographs, there's the one of the little girl who's lying full length, lying back with her hands in her hair. And I find that a rather suggestive pose, very sensual. And there's the other that's less provocative, less sensual, of the little girl by the seashore. And again, this is in the tradition of the fancy picture, the type of bathing picture that Allison was referring to earlier. And there, her nakedness is disguised by the fact that you see her from the side, and her legs are drawn up to her chin. Now, you were saying that Carroll very carefully controlled intent and access, and he very carefully negotiated with the parents, and I assume with the children. There is a letter extant to one of the mothers where he says, well, I'm going to ask her for bare feet first, and if she consents, then, you know, we'll go on to the next thing. So then it will be, you know, just above the knee. And as a French Lewis Carroll scholar, Hugues Lebailly, has pointed out, he was conducting a kind of striptease. And, you know, of course, that's, again, a late 20th century, early 21st century take on it. When we tend to see, you know, we can't look at the body without sexualizing it. And that's part of our culture. But whether Carroll looked at those children's bodies without sexual feeling, I don't know. I think it requires a suspension of disbelief. But I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. And I do think that a great deal more investigation needs to be done. However, if that's, I don't know whether that's possible, because
there's so few.
There are so few. And the, of course, the sitters are long dead. I think probably their grandchildren may be still with us, but there's no direct reminiscence available, no direct anecdotal evidence. Carroll's diaries, of course, were written with an eye to posterity, and while they are revealing in some senses, they're quite careful in other senses.
Connection listeners, we're talking about an exhibit just opened at the Brooklyn Museum of Art. It is called Exposed, the Victorian Nude, sculptures, photographs, oil paintings of a time when we thought everybody wore clothes, even in the bath. 1-800-423-8255. Your thoughts about the Victorian era. Join us on the program. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. This hour, we're talking about the Victorian nude, which is very convenient. It allows us to talk about social morals of a time long past and how could they behave the way they did back then. We should probably remind ourselves of the fact that many of the issues that came up in the late 1800s continue to reside with us today. There's a news story you may remember from the summertime where it is revealed that an email last year sent to an aide in the Justice Department instructed someone there to hang a permanent drape hiding the statues in the Great Hall, where the bare-breasted statues would have been looming over Attorney General John Ashcroft's news conferences. Now, of course, the Justice Department spokeswoman Barbara Comstock, when asked about this, said, no, it's not an issue with the statue. It's having a blue background. She insisted Ashcroft had not ordered the drapes and had never said a word to his aides about the statue. But we could perhaps infer that as a direct descendant of the Protestant ethic of the Victorian age, Mr. Ashcroft was concerned about how he was seen on television. So perhaps what we talk about back then is with us today. Also with us today, Allison Smith. She is the curator of Exposed, the Victorian Nude, which is has just opened at the Brooklyn Museum of Art. Virginia Doty is also there. Virginia's an art historian with a particular interest in a history of photography. Allison, there must have been a part of you that sort of snickered inside putting this together, thinking, I wonder how many people will see themselves in what we're regarding as back then.
I think that's true to a degree. I mean, one of the points of the exhibition was it really holds up a mirror to our own age and the dilemmas we face to get today, or the self-consciousness we have today when sort of negotiating and discussing the nude. And I think through a very intense examination of the debates the Victorians experienced in examining the nude, the idea was that one would indirectly sort of, make people conscious of the fact that we haven't really transcended this doubt. In fact, the doubts are still very much with us today. And some people have gone so far as to argue that, we are the real Victorians, that we're undergoing a new moralism today, which makes the Victorians look quite sort of candid, quite libertarian by comparison.
Well, do you? I should just give out our number for our listeners here. It's 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Do you put any weight, either of you, in the argument put forward by Michel Foucault in his History of Sexuality that the Victorians, in being so actively concerned to describe and analyze and repress sexuality, were in truth then involved in a massive acceleration of sexual discourse? Or was that clever hindsight?
I think that that's something they were very conscious of the time. Virginia mentioned Lewis Carroll earlier on. He was very conscious, I think, in response to one of the great controversies of his day, which was an article published in the Pall Mall Gazette called The Maiden Tribute of Modern Babylon. This was written by a journalist who wanted to expose the traffic in white slavery, the traffic in young girls. He said that the more you talk about it, the more you are really sort of encouraging an appetite for this, and the more you're encouraging a prurient response. So sensationalism and scandal go together, and this leads to this incitement, this fascination with sexuality. So I think something, Foucault wrote about it sort of in the 20th century, but I think the Victorians were there before. They were very sort of conscious that the more the nude is debated, discussed, the more it's shown. They were also very acutely aware of the revolution caused by reproductive technology, not just photographs, but the fact that high art images and sculptures could be reproduced in the form of engravings and photogravures, and they could be shown in print sellers' shops, where outside the secure environment of an art gallery, where nudes would be seen by connoisseurs, i.e. by those educated in the language of the nude, outside that context, they'd be seen by ordinary passers-by who might be shocked by the images or who might just mistake a nude figure for a naked figure. And of course here the whole idea of obscenity and pornography comes into play.
Is Victorian art, Virginia, coming back into fashion, the way we look at it, the way we regard it? Are we just changing the way we see it?
Well, I certainly hope it's coming back into fashion. I've always been a fan, of course. I think that in our era, we have more and more time we have more and more time to look at the past, and therefore we've developed more and more of a fascination with it. Mm-hmm. And we also have now at our disposal wonderful tools for research and discourse, just like this program and the fact that you have it online at the same time, and a wonderful opportunity for the exchange of ideas. So I think that in the context of everything that we can do, I do think that Victorian art will be more closely examined and more widely discussed.
Let's widen our conversation to include Michael, who's called in from Asheboro, North Carolina. Hi, Michael.
Hello. Thank you for having me. Mm-hmm. Enjoying the conversation. I was just wondering, Victorian artists of the time, if we're truly able to reflect back on that period and glean from that meaning from that period, it's fascinating to do so. And I was wondering, are there any contemporary artists that are so bold as to say that their opinion and their images of today's life can be, in the future, translated in the same way as we're doing now with the past?
Okay. Allison, do you want to try that?
Excuse me?
We'll let Allison speak here. Michael, thanks for your question.
I'm going to pass over to Virginia,
okay,
actually.
Okay, yes.
Well, my only reaction to the caller's comments are that I assume that most artists think in terms of what they're going to leave to posterity. Whether there are any artists today who are going to leave the same complexity of ideas and issues that we find in the Victorians, I don't know. I think that I'm not aware of an artist who is dealing with quite the same mix of social mores and individual taste as some of the Victorian artists. How about you, Alison?
I think I'd broadly agree with that. I think, as Pinu said, all artists, have their reputation in mind. But I think by the 21st century, artists have become so sort of wise to the media, to the fact how their images can be used in all sorts of ways. There's now perhaps some even lesser distinction now between, particularly in contemporary art practice, between so-called high art and mass culture. And the boundaries are far more sort of fluid. I think artists are aware how their images can be sort of used in all sorts of ways.
Yes, I'm not sure that there are artists who are ready to be quite as raw, shall we say, and I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. I mean in a sense of, just doing it and letting the public decide. Mm. I think now artists are pretty much aware of their public or, exactly what part of the market they're aiming for, which kind of gallery they want to represent them. The art school is chosen because the teacher is one that particular young artist would like as a mentor and so forth. It's all a little bit more knowing, I think.
All right, Michael, thanks for your call. 1-800-423-8255 to Sauk County, Wisconsin, and Debbie's joining us. Hi, Debbie.
Hi. I'm the grandchild of one of Lewis Carroll's girls.
One of the ones who was photographed.
I don't know if she was photographed, but I know that he would take her out and take her places, and, she was a friend of his when she was quite young. And it occurred.
Debbie, your line's cutting out. Can you start that question again?
Sure. Has anyone studied whether the Lewis Carroll girls' families have a history since then of incest within the families? Because that might indicate, give some indication as to Lewis Carroll's, the effects of Lewis Carroll's interests, if they were sexual.
Well, will your answer to that question be a no?
It would be a yes.
It would be a yes. There is a history in your family.
Yes, yes. Since that, I don't know about before then, but from my grandmother on, yes.
Well, I must say that I'm not really prepared to deal with an issue as important as the one that you brought up, incest. And I do feel for you in that family situation.
Oh.
But, sorry?
It's just that, very often, once these boundaries have been crossed, the girl, when she becomes a mother, is not very protective of her own daughter, and so it's passed on intergenerationally. And so I wondered whether that might give some indication of whether or not Lewis Carroll's interests really were sexual.
It's probably a little unfair to ask our art historians and curators to weigh in on that, Debbie, but just a final one from you. Yeah, go ahead.
Could I just say that actually there is a book that was published a couple of years ago called In the Shadow of the Dream Child by Caroline Leach. It's spelled with a K, Caroline. And in that, she puts forward the notion that Carroll was not in love or obsessed with little girls, that he really cared for mature women and, in fact, had consummated sexual relationships with mature women. And that some of the women that he described as being child friends were, in fact, 18, 20 years old. And this particular writer, Carolyn Leach, is very interested in overturning what she describes as a myth of Carroll's obsession with child friends. So I know that there's been quite a bit of research, trying to put paid to the notion that he somehow was interested in sex with little girls or, acted on his interests. The specific issue that the caller brought up, I don't know that that's been investigated.
Okay. Debbie, thanks for your call. There's one thing, Alison, I wanted to ask you about, and that is a section that you set aside, a room that you set aside in the exhibit for the private nude. Because to me, I mean, just at face value, I thought to myself, ah, these are the ones that can't be shown in the drawing room, that you know, the Victorians had set a certain bar of what would be acceptable to hang in the house in a public room and what might be in, you know, a part of the house where company wasn't expected. Is that a way of looking at it?
So I think that title, The Private Nude, was actually intended to open up questions. Maybe we should put a big question mark at the end of the line, The Private Nude, because I hope to show in that category it's very difficult to establish the distinction between public and private. There are certain works included in that section which really sort of go between the two categories. Take an image, for example, such as Alma Tadema's Tepidarium. This shows, it's a very small painting, it shows a naked woman reclining on a sort of marble slab, holding a stridule in one hand and a feather fan in the other. At first sight, this seems a highly titillating erotic image, and indeed, Alma Tadema did not show it immediately in Britain. Interestingly enough, he decided to show it at a dealer's gallery in Paris, the idea being, of course, that the Parisians would be more accepting of this sort of imagery. Though, interestingly enough, later he did show it in Britain. But intriguingly, this painting was bought by Pears Soap, who considered at one point for using it for advertising purposes, the idea of this sort of woman, you know, reclining after a sort of new the Tepidarium, the lukewarm bath, would be an ideal advertisement for soap. So that implies they're tending to sort of place it in the public sphere. I think Gaines comes back to the point we discussed earlier on about sort of cleanliness and bathing and this pure message it projected. But interestingly enough, they decided not to use it in wake of the controversy about certain images, paintings used for advertising purposes, which were discussed around the time of the Indecent Advertisements Act. So that was one of the images which was included in that section to show that sometimes images went between these definitions of public and private. But on the whole, artists, when they knew they were being, when artists were commissioned to do a work for a private owner, specifically, rather than designing an image for a public exhibition, mm-hmm. they could be far bolder and more daring and provocative in their treatments of the nude. And interesting enough, a lot of these images will show sort of women or men or young children engaging directly with the spectator. It was typical of the established nude to show the figure turning away so it doesn't make direct eye contact. But a lot of those produced for private purposes often show the, the model or the figure engaging directly in a very sort of sexual, provocative way with the spectator.
Alison, thanks so much for coming in. Alison Smith is senior curator at the Tate Britain in London, curator of the exhibit Expose the Victoria Nude in Virginia. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Virginia's director of the Carlsbad Museum of, and Art Center and author of photography captions in the catalog for Exposed the Victoria Nude. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.
This is WBUR.